In later life, Yeats would write love songs and poems prompted by similar impulses, but this time, the cause of the wounds was not imaginary, but real. His lifelong but hopeless love for the Irish actress Maud Gonne, whom he described in one of his poems as the loveliest woman born out of the mouth of plenty's horn. Yeats's love for Maud Gonne never really died. It seemed at times, like many of these loves, to thrive on rejection. Even after Maud Gonne later married a political activist who was executed by the British, Yeats continued to be haunted by his love for a woman who, in fact, did not love him. In a poem called A Deep Sworn Vow, Yeats described in heartbreaking detail the spiritual turmoil of a rejected man who could not stop loving someone even when the love was hopeless.
Others, because you did not keep that deep sworn vow, have been friends of mine. Yet always when I look death in the face, when I clamber to the heights of sleep, or when I grow excited with wine, suddenly I meet your face.
In one of the later poems of his life, Yeats could still not refrain from sounding the same theme. But the cause of his anguish then was not the anguish of disappointment, but the fact that as an older man, he could still be desire's victim while being no longer capable of being its agent. In other words, he was a man still capable of experiencing love, but incapable of being a lover. In one of his last books, Archibald MacLeish wrote of such a predicament in a poem that takes its very title from Yeats, The Wild Old Wicked Man. MacLeish wrote, "Too old for love and still to love, Yeats's predicament and mine." All men's. The aging Adam who must strut and shove and caper his obscene pretense. Yeats confronted this same situation when he wrote a poem called, very simply, Politics. The poem is seemingly an answer to a statement by the German novelist Thomas Mann, who said, "In our time, the destiny of man presents its meaning in political terms." Yeats's poem is really the same as MacLeish's, but there's a bittersweet melody at its core, the melody of a man who could reminisce about a time when he lived with never a crack in my heart, but who now must live with the pangs that age has dealt him.
How can I? That girl standing there, my attention fixed on Roman or on Russian or on Spanish politics. Yet here's a traveled man that knows what he talks about. And there's a politician that has both read and thought. Maybe what they say is true of war and war's alarms. But oh, that I were young again and held her in my arms.
Yeats might have been destined to write such poems of delicious lyrical suffering indefinitely, both personal and mythological, had not something happened to redefine his life as a poet. That something was Ireland itself. Not the Ireland of myth, but the Ireland of fact and struggle. It's even possible to claim that Yeats saw this transformation coming in 1913, when he wrote, "Romantic Ireland's dead and gone, it's with O'Leary in the grave." This foretelling became an absolute fact in 1916 and continued until 1920, the years that the Irish refer to as the time of the Troubles. The underlying cause of the Troubles was simply the Irish refusal to live under the British thumb. The history of subjugation was deep in the Irish consciousness. It included the unforgettable endorsement of British policy toward the Irish by no less a poet than Edmund Spenser when he wrote, "Great force must be the instrument, but famine must be the mean, for till the Irish be famished, they cannot be subdued." Then there was the curse of Cromwell, who ordered his soldiers to smash the harps in every Irish household, symbolizing the crushing of the Irish imagination. There were laws forbidding the Irish to wear green, to speak their own language, to vote, to be educated, to practice their religion, and so on. All of these ongoing injustices, when coupled with punitive taxes and other abuses, led a group of men, many of them poets, to occupy the post office in Dublin in 1916 and proclaim in a post office a free Ireland. Somehow they and a force of 700 Irish volunteers held off a British force of 20,000 before they were captured, tried, and many of them shot. Yeats commemorated their sacrifice in a dialogue entitled "The Rose Tree." The speakers are two of the leaders of that revolt, Pádraig Pearse and James Connolly, and the rose, of course, is a symbol of Ireland itself.
"O word are lightly spoken," said Pearse to Connolly. "Maybe a breath of politic words has withered our rose tree, or maybe but a wind that blows across the bitter sea." "It needs to be watered," James Connolly replied, "to make the green come out again and spread on every side and shake the blossom from the bud to be the garden's pride." "But where can we draw water," said Pearse to Connolly, "when all the wells are parched away? Oh, plain as plain can be, there's nothing but our own red blood can make a right rose tree."